This is Audible.
Podium Audio presents Necromancer, Book 10 of the Spellmonger series, written by Terry Mancor, performed by John Lee. Prologue. I watched my son's face contort into an expression of fascinated terror as he ran for his life. His face was red and flushed, and his eyes had the wild look of one desperately dodging a predator as he searched for the danger he knew lurked nearby. A moment later, a blood-curdling, ear-splitting scream from his sister informed him of where his predator was hiding. Desperate, he rolled across the floor and under the trestle table, just as his foe appeared. "Where is that tasty little boy?" a great voice boomed, making him shiver in terror. "Where is my breakfast?" Minalyan clapped his hands over his mouth to keep from screaming in horror. When the huge figure finally crept into the room, one could see why the lad was terrified. The great beard and hair of the creature was a chaotic sight, standing up and out like so many spikes. The eyes between were wide and scary, and the mouth that called for the unlikely meal was smeared with the residue of his previous victims, raspberry tarts.
"Here I am,"
Minalyan finally announced, rolling out from under the trestle and leaping atop a stool with surprising alacrity. He brandished a three-day-old long baguette in his hands like a greatsword and challenged the monster.
"You will not eat me."
"I will eat every tasty morsel,"
the flower monster roared as he charged. Minalyan didn't hesitate. With a mighty swing of his stale weapon, he leapt across the kitchen and delivered a fury of blows that defeated the beast and broke the batard in two, sending it flying across the kitchen as the flower monster howled and growled at the heat of the combat. Almina stood in the doorway, eyes wide and hands over her mouth, as she watched her big brother duel with a giant ogre who periodically snuck into their home after work and terrorized them. As valiant as Minalyan's attack was, no one defeats the flower monster. I'd learned that a lifetime ago. He picked up the little boy and swung him into the air, ripping up his tunic and burying his bushy, flowery beard into his tender belly and began chomping. Minalyan erupted into a squirmy, giggly scream that was only slightly less nerve-slicing than his sister's, until he begged for the flower monster to relent and release him. "Run along now," my father said with an exhausted sigh, as he gave each of them a raspberry tart from the shop and sent them outside to play in the yard.
"That is so much fun," he admitted, out of breath from the infant-eating effort, as he sat on the stool Min vacated. "But I don't remember being this tired when I ate you and your sisters for breakfast. We were easier to catch," I assured him with a smile, "and 20-odd years ago, children were slower and more docile." We both chuckled at that. My father had been enjoying his grandchildren immensely, both my two and the brood that Yura and Borsa brought with them when my family came to Sevendor. While two of the other sisters and their husbands were preparing to return to Talrion Borain in Varun with my father, Yura's and Borsa's husbands had elected to stay in their brother's barony and run the prosperous bakery here. My father was surrounded by his grandchildren, and then some. Four of his girls and his son had spent the last year or so keeping him in a state of paternal bliss as he got to know them all. The entire family had taken residence in the baker's hall, an elaborate home I'd had constructed for the purpose within the outer bailey of the castle. Dad spent most of the day at the bakery, as he had since long before I was born, but when he was ready to turn the day's bake over to his apprentices, he brought home a basket of whatever goodies he'd made that day and, on certain occasions, would slick up his hair with flour and water to create the role that had terrified and delighted us since we were tots. "You've got a brave one there,"
he nodded admiringly to my son, chasing his little sister into the yard.
"I've been whacked by more stale bread this year than in the 20 before. He doesn't shy away from being scared, like Almina," he observed.
"She enjoys being scared too much to attack. She's 3, I reminded him.
"Reminds me of Borsa at her age," he recalled fondly. "Always a squealer, that one. But that boy of yours is braver than them all, he said, referring to my three nephews who'd arrived with the rest of my family. All good, strong boys, but with more sense than boldness. Minalion, on the other hand, was fearless. He must get it from his mother. He'd better be, I sighed. He'll have to defend this place when I'm gone. Timidity is not often characteristic of a mage lord. It's like he wants to fight the world. He's gotten worse about it since his mother went away, I said, trying to say the words casually. He'll approach a stray dog, bold as brass, and demand it identify itself. When is he going to get to see her again? My father asked, hesitantly. It was a touchy subject, and he knew it. For months I'd been obsessed with discovering some way, either mundane or arcane, to restore my wife Alia's mind to her, after it had been shattered during the wizard war at Greenflower. She was fine, physically. On that the brightest medical and magical minds of the kingdom could agree. But her psyche had sustained a powerful shock by a witch stone she'd destroyed. Since that fateful night, she'd been in the care of the priestesses of Trigg at the Holy Hill Abbey. I visited every fortnight, sometimes more. But there had been scant improvement for months, until I'd discovered that the legendary sorceress of Sartha Wood was, in fact, a slightly batty Alka-Alon rebel, imprisoned with her staff in a small compound in the middle of the Upper Riverlands, one who was trained in ancient human medicine and advanced Alka-Alon magic. Lilastian, as she was properly known, had taken over Alia's care at Yule, and she'd shown some immediate improvement, but there were limits to what even the sorceress could accomplish. Soon, I hope, I answered non-committally. She's getting a little better every day. It wasn't a lie. She was. But better is a relative term, judged by condition. On any given day she wasn't as bad as the previous day, therefore she was better. It wasn't a lie. But the truth was, Alia wasn't going to get much better on her own. That, at least, Lilastian the sorceress had been able to tell me. In fact, the only treatment she even suspected might help was locked away deep in a cavern under a ruined city, inhabited by humanity's deadliest foes. The only way it could be of help was to recover an ancient spirit from inside a rock and somehow bring it back to Sevendor, where it might be able to glue Alia's fractured mind back together. Maybe. Possibly. If I could figure out and overcome more obstacles and barriers than any mage had before. If I could manage an enchantment that no one had any idea how to cast, much less cast properly. If I could manage all that and do so without getting myself killed, Alia might, possibly, with the help of the gods and more fortune than I was ever due, recognize her children again. Maybe. So you've decided to go after it, then? He asked softly, knowing my thoughts without me speaking. Dad is quite intuitive for a baker. I don't see that I have much choice, I said, resigned. The handmaiden is the only thing I've even heard about that might work. It seems a hard thing, depending upon an old legend for hope, he offered. I wish this was an old legend, I snorted. Most old legends have a grain of truth to them. This is just a half-remembered encounter from the mind of a half-crazy old Alka-Alon lady from centuries ago, and it's the best course I have left.
Minalan, you said that handmaiden was in a cave, deep under a city that you've already seen ruined once,
he reminded me, on an island in the middle of a lake in mountains higher than these,
guarded by dragons and covered with goblins.
Yes, I nodded. That is what I said. He sighed expressively and started to shake the dried flower from his beard.
But you're going to go anyway,
he concluded. Yes. Yes, I am. Alone, if I have to.
No, you won't go alone,
he said, shaking his head and sending a shower of flour to the wooden floor.
You have too many friends who are too eager to help you. But be careful, Min,
he cautioned.
I know you're a big, tough war mage and wizard and all, but
walking into Orlan Seheri like it's a baronial fair and expecting to find what I need is suicidal, stupid, and hopelessly naive.
I knew you were a smart one,
he snorted. I know the dangers, Dad, or at least I suspect I do. and it's far, far more dangerous than you think. I informed him, Ulam Seheri isn't just full of goblins. It's full of undead. My apprentices made a full report, and the place is crawling with walking corpses, led by Korbald the Necromancer.
The demon god of the Mindens, he chuckled wryly. Now that is an old legend,
and one with more than a grain of truth to it, I agreed. He's actually not a god at all, just a powerful Alka-Alon necromancer who pissed off the council 1,000 years ago or so. They imprisoned him in a tomb along with his followers. Unfortunately, he was awakened by yet more of his followers. Now they're building an army, raising dragons and generally threatening, well, everything. My dad shook his head again.
I don't know how you wizards do it, he admitted. I've watched you pursue your craft for years, one way or another. War magic, spellmongering, and now... all this, he said, gesturing toward my barony at large. It seems too much work, compared to baking, he added.
I didn't take offense. I am in a profession that prides itself on obscurity and obfuscation, and while the practice of magic on its own doesn't mandate that sort of mysterious approach, the business of magic encourages it. Honestly, the heart of a wizard's work isn't even about magic, I decided. It's about getting things done, either for a client or yourself, mostly by convincing other people to do the hard parts for you.
That's what apprentices are for,
he nodded and smiled. Over the years, Dad had trained at least 8 or 9 apprentices. 4 of them had married my sisters. Oh, they're helpful, I agreed, but that's not what I'm speaking of. A wizard's talent provides access to power, but even with a witch stone, that's not usually enough to accomplish much. Oh, I do things with magic all the time. But being a wizard goes beyond mastering the arcane. It is far more about knowing when and how to use magic to change the universe, and when not to use magic and use more subtle means instead.
So what's the point of studying so damn much magic?
He asked. It was a common complaint of his that I had Ruderal and Dara, my 2 apprentices, constantly reading and taking notes on 7 centuries of accumulated knowledge and lore about our profession. Dad considered that excessive, but then most bakers weren't even literate.
The magic opens the door,
I explained, struggling for a metaphor, but it is your understanding of the universe that gives you the ambition to go through it. To be honest, most of my work these days involves wandering around, talking to people, listening to things, and quietly arranging for them to want to do what I want them to do. Sometimes by persuasion, sometimes by coercion, but one of the benefits of wisdom is understanding enough about the limitations of your own power that you can get other people to do the heavy lifting.
Sounds more like a priest than a wizard.
Dad wasn't unfamiliar with the priesthood. As a master baker, he was a high-ranking lay member of the Temple of Brigga.
The two are not dissimilar, I agreed. The difference is that, ideally, a wizard is convincing other people to do things for the greater good. A priest does so for the glory or adoration of his divinity.
The two are not always the same.
So what was Dunsellan doing for the greater good?
He asked, curious. It was an insightful question. Anyone who dismissed Dad's wit because of his choice of profession was an idiot. Believe it or not, I think Dunsellan was trying to figure out how the Snowstone spell worked, which would have been for the greater good. His methods, on the other hand, were not particularly ethical. I wasn't even going to mention Issili's role in his researches or his ethical breaches. Dad knew enough of the story to not bring her up. He'd even met the 2 grandchildren Isili bore me, against my will, when Taran brought them briefly to Sevendor for examination. Dunsellan was a good mage, objectively speaking, but a very poor wizard.
So what makes you a good wizard?
I get other people to do stuff for me as much as possible, I decided, and I try not to lose sight of the important things, like the greater good.
Or providing a mother for your children,
he added, as he watched Almina chase her brother now, as he chased a chicken through the yard. Or defending the kingdom against goblin invasion, undead incursions, and the occasional dragon. Yes, there is a lot to it, especially at my level, And to be honest, there are limits to what I can do. Magic might give me leverage, but it's often as problematic as it is helpful. I think I probably accomplish as much by subtlety and a whispered word in the right ear as I do with incantations and Irionite. But I must continue to study it, I continued. Indeed, I have an appointment with Kedaran the Black this afternoon to study necromancy. Dad shivered involuntarily, and I couldn't blame him. He hadn't even seen a walking corpse before. I had. I didn't have the heart to explain to him that the reality was far worse than his imaginings.
That's the part of this profession I don't like, he admitted, through pursed lips. The enchantments are helpful. The spells have turned this place into a going concern. But when you delve into such dark places, Min, I worry.
You should, I agreed emphatically. Necromancy is... it's not something Imperial magic has encouraged the study of, for a reason. Reanimation is creepy and fraught with ethical dilemmas. It's one step beyond human sacrifice, according to some scholars, and merely a natural extension of already existing magical principles to their logical conclusion, according to another group. A smaller group, I added, and yes, everyone thinks they're creepy.
Well, you play around with dead people, folk are going to talk, he observed.
It's not something you can get away with in the village, I agreed. Necromancy was all but forbidden by the censorate. It was a moot point for the most part, because without Irionite, it took a necromancer 3 or 4 days to accumulate enough power to cast the spell. It only lasted a few hours, and the results were usually disappointing. So very few went past basic theory, and those who did were subject to penalties.
So why do it at all? Seems creepy.
Because Korbal is a necromancer, and he studied necromancy for longer than humanity has been on this world. Not only are he and his followers undead, the creatures he's creating out of the corpses of slaves are far more sophisticated than anything human necromancers have ever produced. I need to know more about the practice, at least in theory, if I am going to be able to challenge him. Dad winced. He'd never gotten over the idea of me risking my life, and I'm sure the idea of me fighting against some undead ghoul was abhorrent.
Son,
he said, which he almost never called me unless he was about to impart some profound piece of fatherly wisdom.
Perhaps I've been too preoccupied by the possibility of my own death to see the subject as one for much study, except in how to avoid it. But it doesn't exactly seem wholesome to be mucking around with such things.
Wizards do a great many things that aren't very wholesome, I chuckled, thinking of some of my war magic buddies. Death magic is particularly slippery to consider, for a host of technical reasons beyond the mere moral issues. It's a natural human fascination, I pointed out.
You yourself admit to thinking about it.
Too much, I emphasized.
When a man has this many grandchildren, he knows his time among them is limited, he sighed. Don't worry, I feel hale enough for my age. But every winter is harder, and one more closer to the last one. Any father understands that, he said gently, nor is there shame or worry in it. But I wouldn't mind not dying, he added.
The quest for immortality has been constant among humanity, I said philosophically. The Wenshari Magi had an entire cult around it. Necromancy is a natural magical extension of that desire, with dreadfully disappointing results. No human spell has managed more than the simplest reanimation. Your soul doesn't get popped back into your body. Your dead flesh is merely propelled by magic at the direction of another, like I did with the water elemental in the pond, only with rotting human flesh instead of nice, clean water.
But not Korbal, Dad said,
as he poured water into the basin to wash the flour off of his face.
No, Korbal's necromancy does allow some bit of your mind to return, I conceded. That's the problem.
He's using a very sophisticated necromancy, and I don't even know simple necromancy.
You'll figure it out, Min, he said confidently, as he patted his face dry with a towel,
and then tossed it on the side of the basin where my mother could complain about it.
You're a smart lad. Always were. We're going to miss you,
he sighed. I'm going to miss you all, too, I agreed. The kids especially. They've kept Min and Almina distracted, and that's worth a lot to me. Dad and Baron Lethar had come to an arrangement to reopen the bakery back in Talry, after the Temple of Brigga lifted its interdiction on the barony. They were planning on leaving in just a few more weeks. Dad was only taking half of the household he left with, as two of his former apprentices would be staying on here, with my sisters, and continue to run the Seven-Door Town Bakery. Mom and Dad had enjoyed getting to know their grandchildren and their daughter-in-law, but it was time for them to head back home, and we all knew it.
"They're beautiful children," he assured me, "as pretty as their mother, as smart as their father. All your children are beautiful, but they'll be happier with their mother. If you can find a way to restore her."
"I've done almost nothing else," I agreed. "This is likely the best option I have."
"Then do what you have to do, son," he said.
For no particular reason, his words filled me with confidence I hadn't felt before. I wasn't exactly fishing for his validation, but getting it unexpectedly made it all the more potent.
"I will, Dad," I promised. "If it means chasing Corbal into his darkest cellar and beating him to death with the bloody stump of his own arm, then I'll find a way to do it."
"Are there more tarts? Those were delicious."
Interlude 1. Pentandra. The Conspiracy. Pentandra regarded her young guest with a mixture of admiration and trepidation over a cup of tea in the garden of her country estate. Ordinarily, it would be too cold to consider lingering outside for any length of time, but that was under the old, feeble wizards of the court. In her very first days at the estate, she'd enchanted the gardens with an invisible dome that allowed the air within to stay considerably warmer than the chill Wilderland weather outside. It made conversations like this one a bit more pleasant to have, outside in the daylight.
"So I hope you can appreciate my dilemma," Katina finished, as she set down the teacup. "I really don't see what else I can do."
Pentandra considered the girl's problem. Fortunately, she seemed to be working along with the currents of fate, not against them, for her sake. Else Pentandra would have to dissuade her, or at least challenge her cause.
"I do see the problem,"
Pentandra finally admitted.
"Oft the gods present these challenges to us, seemingly out of spite, when what we desire is so close, but yet seems unobtainable. But I am not a priestess," she said, tossing up her hands. "I am a wizard, and where the gods fail, magic prospers."
"Yet it seems an impossible task,"
Katina lamented.
"Not impossible," Pentandra said quickly. "Just highly unlikely. Let me think."
The pretty coast lord sat with perfect feminine patience while Pentandra thought. When Katina appeared on her doorstep so unexpectedly, she'd been surprised. The young shadow mage was in a desperate mood, however, and chose to appeal to the court wizard of the court in exile instead of taking matters into her own hands. Her dark sable gown and beautiful silver necklace was at odds with the other garments she'd seen the girl wear. She was appealing to Pentandra not just as a mage and administrator, counselor to his grace, but also as a woman. At last, Pentandra sighed, patting her growing belly.
"The problem is that the political situation is so dire," she said, letting her eyes light on the hills in the distance, rather than her guest. "That may or may not seem to hold bearing on your problem, my dear, but I assure you that it does. You know the push to have the Count of Reims named Duke in Anguin's stead?" she asked.
"Intimately,"
Katina said flatly.
"His party, and those of the other rebels, has made it a practice of extolling the virtues of such a move. Only the Count of Verona stands to object, and he is quickly seeing the advantages of letting another claim the coronet."
"That must not happen," Pentandra insisted. "I need more information. How would you say is Anguin viewed in the south?"
"By the nobility? As a foolish boy under Rard's thumb and a lackey of House Bimin, pretending to be Duke while hiding in the woods. By the people, he is barely known at all.
And the Gavani invasion,
considered a myth by all but the highest nobles,"
Katina confirmed.
Duke Lengwin is seen to have lost half the Wilderlands due to his own incompetence as a war leader.
Castal's fleet, she prompted, openly scorned as part-time warrior merchants, inadequate to face the vast Alshari fleets if they had the Stormlord himself on the tiller.
And the undead?
Hollow tales of drunken mariners,
Katina said, with a sniff of disgust. Stories of how they are infiltrating the swamplands are obscured,
yet the Nemovorti continue to recruit. Their agents prowl the slave pens looking for the finest hosts, she said distastefully.
Others are taken at night or off the street and never seen again.
Magi especially are prone to such disappearances, as if we are being hunted.
More and more villages go silent as their headmen and elders are taken, slain and reanimated. It is said that even the Count of Karamas is now under their direct sway, she added worriedly.
Pentandra thought in silence a few more moments, as if she were matching up the particulars of the situation with some prophecy or another.
I can't think of a way, she began hesitantly, but it will take much work, coin, and a number of very brave men, and magic, lots of magic.
Coin I have in plenty, she reminded Pentandra, and what I lack I'll steal.
The prospect of work has never bothered me, and there are brave men aplenty in the Wilderlands, she observed.
What magic we need I shall secure.
I assure you, my lady, I am committed to this cause.
What price you ask of me I shall be happy to pay.
Pentandra couldn't argue with that.
We shall come to that in a moment, she decided.
Manpower wasn't the problem. Where it was and where it wasn't, that was the problem. But one thing at a time, she decided.
If you want to work to our mutual benefit, she told her guest, then among the first things that must be done is to remind an Ultramar that they have a very real duke and one who is not pretending in the slightest.
Katina smiled, and her lavender eyes widened in a way that made Pentandra shiver a little inside. The girl was determined, that was certain.
Just what do you suggest, my lady? She asked,
leaning forward expectantly.
Actually, my plan has several parts, she said, but the first will involve a journey back to Phallas.
A clandestine journey, she emphasized.
No one ever notices a cat, she shrugged, nodding toward where a big tabby that lived in the barn was sprawled on a sunny ledge.
Just so, Pentandra nodded. Once the message is delivered, and I speak to my cousin Planus for some essential supplies, we can progress to the next part of the plan. It will also require some assistance from Sevendor, assistance that I cannot let Minolan know about without compromising him. But Lord Bannermore owes me a favour or three, and Gareth is suddenly available, I hear. I can acquire what you need.
And warriors?
Warriors we have in plenty,
Pentandra assured her.
Since the arrival of the Third Commando and the influx of Wilderlords for the weapon take, we now have thousands of soldiers. I know just the type to undertake this task. A highly risky task, even under the best of circumstances, she reminded her guest.
I am aware of the potential consequences, my lady, Katina said, nodding her head.
Should things go ill, it is likely that all involved will face execution. Unless the soil is prepared properly, this garden shall not bear fruit, or even sprout.
Understood, my lady. Katina nodded.
I think I know what needs to be done to till it before the planting, and then water it.
Liberally, she grinned.
You may need to remove some offensive weeds along the way,
she warned her.
Hard work and dirty hands never bother me, if the fruit is juicy enough, she countered.
I will not be able to help much in my present condition, she pointed out, patting her tummy.
I would feel cheated if I could not claim the satisfaction of this achievement for my own,
Katina declared.
Your counsel and wisdom are assistance enough, my lady.
Well spoken,
Pentandra approved.
Then I can do what I will to assist, with the understanding that the onus for success or failure lies on your shoulders.
It must be a conspiracy for now, perhaps until it is concluded.
The greater the prize, the greater the glory,
Katina quoted.
I shall speak of it to no one, save my mother, she advised.
Then let us begin,
Pentandra said, conjuring a blank sheet of parchment out of her amulet. She'd had it modified since she became court wizard
to produce such helpful things when needed. A quill and inkpot followed. She began the letter to her friend and colleague, using some coded terms that she would understand.
I shall send this to Lady Carmella to make the initial arrangements.
Yes.
Yes, I think that she'll have precisely what you need to proceed.
Allora,
she called to the cat. It wagged the tip of its tail but once in response.
Have one of the pages sent to me to bear a message to Verone,
she instructed the cat.
You summon your apprentice. Mind to mind?
Gattina asked, confused.
No, the nosy girl has been listening in the entire time,
Pentandra explained as she wrote, through the ears of Lord Fuzzypaws over there.
Ah, a beastmaster,
Gattina nodded, understanding.
Yes, a highly useful quality. When it isn't irritating me,
she conceded, looking purposefully at the bored-looking tabby cat.
As apprentices go, I could do worse,
she admitted. She does look after me when Lord Arborne is out ranging, as he is now.
Will Duke Anguin be angry if we come to harvest, Lady Pentandra?
Gattina asked, concerned.
My dear, we are so far away from harvest that such considerations really just don't bear consideration,
Pentandra dismissed.
What you are attempting is so far-fetched and unlikely that, well, by the time Anguin learns of it, you will either be dangling from the end of the traitor's noose, or you will be triumphant.
Worrying about such things before they are at hand is pointless.
I submit to your wisdom, my lady,
Gattina agreed.
We can get Tyndall and Rondald to assemble the men,
she decided, as she finished the note to Carmella a few moments later.
We need not share our intent. The less they know of this, the better for now. The best kinds of conspiracies employ agents who do not realize they are such. I shall come up with a clever excuse for doing so.
Won't they feel betrayed if we come to a successful harvest?
If we are successful,
Pentandra countered, then they will spend their energies gleaning from the field of victory, she promised. A moment later, Allura appeared, being led by a scrawny young servant. Her raven, Lucky, was perched on her shoulder.
I come with Barstan, my lady,
she called unnecessarily. Pentandra nodded to the lad as he bowed, gave him the letter, and bid him to deliver it as quickly as possible. She could have used mind-to-mind communication, she knew, but Pentandra also knew that Carmella was a wizard of intense concentration when she was working. Considering she was laboring to build a ducal keep in a tenth the time, and at half the expense of normal, she really didn't need to distract the war mage in the middle of the day. Not for something that would require a little finesse on her part. When the boy left to get a horse from the stable, Pentandra regarded her blonde apprentice.
Allura, you do realize that this should be kept discreet,
she reminded her incautious apprentice. The blonde girl snorted.
As if I could understand one single thing you two said,
she accused.
First you speak in riddles, then of warriors, then of conspiracies, and then of gardening. Does no one in this court speak plainly?
She asked, exasperated.
There are good reasons to keep secrets, sometimes,
Pentandra explained patiently.
Lady Gattina has ambitions that require the assistance of the court wizard. Thankfully, her ambitions coincide with the good of the realm. Thus, I am supporting her endeavors. Well, unless they involve growing peppers or potatoes, I have no idea what you were talking about,
Allura said, annoyed.
And that is perfectly fine by me. It's bad enough to find that your quarters have been consumed by the dragon,
she began, complaining,
but then to be shipped off to this boring old place, out in the middle of... Thank you, Allura. That will be all,
Pentandra said, rolling her eyes.
Is that like I'm stupid or anything?
The girl continued.
I know you were talking about an ultramar and... Thank you, Allura, that will be all,
Pentandra repeated more forcefully.
Yes, mistress,
Allura said, curtsying sarcastically.
I swear to Trig, every day it's a new ruse, a new deception, a new... Thank you, Allura,
Pentandra said, nearly angry. When the blind girl returned to the hall, and Pentandra glanced at the tabby cat and continued.
Clearly, you've established the desire for a change in leadership in your own mind, my dear, else you would not have come. My motivations are not so pure, I'm afraid, my lady,
Gattina demurred.
Your motivations are as pure as any a maid possessed,
chided Pentandra in return.
The gods rarely put what we desire in easy reach, for what glory then in its attainment? No, Lady Katina, I admit I admire your willingness to pursue your heart's desire. No wizard worth the name could have chosen a worthier goal. Thank you, my lady,
Katina said, standing and giving Pentandra a perfect curtsy.
I stand much in your debt, if I succeed. And if you fail?
Pentandra asked the obvious question.
If I fail, I expect you to arrange a rescue before my neck is stretched,
she confided.
Failing that, arrange for a heroic funeral oratory in my honour to celebrate the noble futility of the endeavour, to serve as inspiration or warning to others,
she suggested.
I could do no less, my lady, for one so brave during a time so tumultuous,
Pentandra agreed.
I still don't know what in three hells you're talking about,
Allura screamed from the hall.
And another piece of professional advice, my dear. Be very, very careful about the quality of apprentice you take,
she advised.
You never quite know what you're going to get.
Part 1. The Spellmonger's Bargain. Chapter 1. The Departure of Draenors. My parents were not the only ones to be leaving Sevendor soon. Another departure was occurring sooner, and required my attention. It is customary, when letting go a retainer who has provided good and faithful service, to send them off with gifts and praise as they move along to a better position. It's just good management. When the retainer in question is making the jump from baronial court wizard to count and member of the peerage, the occasion merits a grand gift and an extended personal visit. I came to see you off to press your candidacy, and wish you both luck and blessings as you press your case, I told Draenus, as he saw the last few crates from his empty laboratory packed into a Hoxter pocket in his new war staff. That doesn't mean I don't regret losing you. You've done a masterful job in Sevendor. Most of the common items in the small tower on the wall of the inner bailey that had become the home for my court wizard were staying for Master Loico. Elementary texts and references, basic lab equipment, common tools of enchantment and thaumaturgy. But he was taking a number of enchantments he'd constructed in the last year with him in his bid to become the Count of Moros. Deadly ones.
It is my duty, as well as my legacy,
the Ramiran nodded, turning to face me. He'd had the barber shave his head entirely, allowing his bushy eyebrows to dominate his forehead unopposed. It gave him a much more dangerous look.
My half-brother, Inutulius, has enjoyed 3 years of interim appointment since my father's death. In that brief time he has allowed my father's legacy to decline damnably. The people of Moros are poorly led and trained, the roads are in poor repair, and the castles are neglected in favour of the estates, and the arsenals are laughable. My late father would be livid. It is in a poor situation for defence, which is the primary responsibility of a count. Inutulius intends to take the position permanently and use it much as my uncle did, before my father restored the position, as a means of enriching himself, not properly seeing to his office.
I don't fault your ambition, I assured him as I took a seat in his chamber. Quite the contrary. I support your bid, but I wouldn't expect it to be an easy challenge. There are still many who fear a mage lord in such a high position, I warned.
I've spent enough time preparing, Minilan, he said thoughtfully. My tenure in Sevendor has been invaluable. I am twice the wizard I was when I came here. I have Irionite, and I am enough a man to admit that you have been my best teacher.
That took me aback. I hadn't realized I'd been teaching anything. How so?
In innumerable ways, he said, amused at my surprise. The lessons I've learned in statecraft alone, as I watched how you elevated Sevendor to a barony and changed the course of a war by supporting your vassals. You are a canny and subtle mage, Lord Minilan, far more than you give yourself credit for. Yet you bank your ambitions, play a long game, and seek as much to promote your allies in secret as you do yourself in public.
I do. I had no idea.
Far from seeing such generosity punished by betrayal, you seem to thrive at every turn. The Baroness, not withstanding, he added sympathetically. I looked away uncomfortably. I've always been self-conscious about earnest praise from my professional peers. It's a lot easier to endure sycophants. They don't get as disappointed when you fall on your ass as your real admirers do. I'm glad you've taken something of value from your stay here, I said, letting the moment pass.
Oh, I have,
he said, as he picked up one of the sentry rods he'd built to support his quest for the county, giving it an appreciative look.
In many ways.
The sentry rods were deadly magical weapons that were designed for the dedicated war magi who protected each of my domains. Trainers had assisted in the development of the prototype, and then helped oversee their production. Then he ordered 30 of them from Sevendor's Bouleuterion for his own use, empowering them using his own shard of Irionite. They could be wielded by anyone with a lick of talent and proper instruction, and they were worth about a company of infantry each. I had no doubt they would be instrumental in his coming war.
I also appreciate you hiring so many war magi for your effort, I chuckled. The number of brawls at the Sword and Staff has declined precipitously of late, so Bannermore says.
I need good men I can trust. One good thing about Sevendori war magi is that they're loyal.
So what is your plan? I asked simply, as he stowed the last of the sentry rods into his staff's hoxter.
Professional interest,
I added. I will retire to my domain of Viridagro, where my bastard cousin Calidus has been gathering my forces, he said, as he packed up one of the mirrors he'd purchased during his tenure in Sevendor. I now have 40 veteran war magi who have enlisted in the effort, 6 companies of mercenaries, quartered in inns and friendly estates across Moros. When I attend the spring conclave of the Moros League, I shall impugn the leadership of Dull in Atulius and challenge the idea that he has effectively undertaken the office, as the council will be held in Rubium Fula, he said, raising an eyebrow. The seat of the Count. My brother will not be able to escape the challenge or dismiss it as hearsay.
How will that be received? I asked curiously.
One who has been forced to dabble in politics does well to observe the political movements of others. At least that was what Pentandra told me, and she's always right. She told me that, too.
Well, in some quarters, I believe,
he considered with a smile, I have had my cousin quietly ensure a favourable reception among several of the lords of the League. It's cost me some gold, but I can depend upon 6 domains and the favour of a baron at the onset. Perhaps as many as 4 others will support me of their own accord, for the poor esteem in which they hold Count Tempors in Atulius. He has made a few enemies on his own, without my agent's intervention. It's just terrible.
The unfortunate but embarrassing events that have stricken my poor deficient half-brother, he said with mock sorrow.
It sounds as if bribery isn't the only mission your agents have undertaken, I said, fishing for information.
How did you know?
He asked innocently, his dark eyebrows dancing over his bald pate.
I've had a squadron of war magi quietly souring the soup of Moros for the last year. Quite a number of important issues for which the office is responsible have suddenly sprung up, much to the consternation of my noble peers.
Feudal management is fraught with challenges, I agreed. It didn't take much to disturb the delicate operation of a manor or a domain if you looked at the situation with an open mind. Draenus had learned the lessons of the Sashtalia War well.
Thrice since last duel, an important bridge in the northern part of the county has failed. An illegal war between an ambitious knight, Banneret, and a neglected eastern estate owned by the Count has involved its neighbours in a scandalous fashion. 3 prestigious abbeys which depend on the beneficence of the Count have had troubling episodes of fire, fungus, and flooded stores, requiring additional support from Inatulius, when he can scarce afford to grant it. A horrific scandal about a sergeant in the county's garrison and a squire has arisen, calling into question the leadership of my brother's castellan. That sort of thing.
Just the sort of problems to cast doubt on the abilities of a political appointee to a functional job, I nodded, especially in the eyes of the average noble who doesn't see much in return for his fees to the county.
Why, Minilan, what an astute observation, he chuckled. When I present my challenge, Inatulius and his allies will be forced to defend. At some point he will lose his temper, do something rash, and I can declare war on him legally.
How can you make war on a sitting count? I asked, confused. I thought that was forbidden by Duin's law.
Ah, only if the man holding the office is judged competent and is accepted by the Duke, he informed me. In the case of a temporary appointment, such as Inatulius enjoys, according to the law, any noble under his purview can challenge his competence through the purifying struggle of warfare. If a man can't defend himself against such a challenge, clearly he has no business running the defences of the entire county. The rank of count was an interesting one. Usually it came with some lands dedicated to the office, but just as a baron had a responsibility to represent the duke or king, and vice versa, a count's position was less direct. A count was responsible for the collective security of an entire region. It was a military office, first and foremost, not a civil one. That didn't require a military man necessarily, but at least a leader who could hire the proper military men to see to the defence of a region. In most places, the local count had dominion over the military disposition of the baronies and domains under his control. That included fines for failure, maintenance of major roads and bridges, maintenance and improvement of the large castles associated with the office, oversight of the militia training and postal service within his county, and a couple of other services considered essential for the post. He paid for it all with a mixture of revenues from his lands and fees taken for any number of occasions. Squiring, knighting, admission to the militia, tolls on bridges and roads, and an assessment from each domain under his purview. While counts were technically prohibited from making war on their own name as a count, except under very specific circumstances, a count could, and often did, encourage others to do so on his behalf. A count often held lands in addition to his official estates, and using the dominance of his office to improve his private holdings was common. The appointment of a new count usually meant holding a meeting of the barons and leading nobles of the county and selecting one among their number to elevate to that position. Once elected, or selected, depending on the custom, they met regularly after that to discuss the efficacy of the count and military issues haunting the county. In County Lensley, the Riverlords League played that role. I'd never gone to the moot, but Baron Arathaniel was very involved in the politics of the county. The occasion was used for knighting prominent noblemen at the apex of their training, overseeing regulation for the conscription, pay, and training of local peasant militias, that sort of thing. But there were a lot of variations, due to tradition, favoritism, and ducal law. In some places, the count held the position as it was intended, and rigorously saw to the defence of his baronies. In others, strong barons, or the distractions of feudal business, encouraged the count to neglect his duties, turning them over to his friends without oversight. That was the sort of thing that had happened in Morrows, from what I understood. Depending on the duchy and the local tradition, when there was a vacancy or weakness in the office, it was either left to the duke to appoint a replacement, acceptable to the barons and nobles, or a local council of those nobles voted on one from among their number, and the duke approved, if found agreeable. In Wenshire and the Remeran Riverlands, it was the latter system. That's what made Drainer's ambitions particularly important. If he could convince the barons and knights elector of Morrows to select him, it was highly unlikely that the fairly weak Duke of Remire, Clofallon, would object. But there was a lot to do before that happened. Nearly two-thirds of the lords in the council, from what Ayugi, my magical spy, had learned, were either opposed or ambivalent about the idea of electing a count who was a mage lord. But it was not impossible, my spy had added, when I'd sent him to explore the issue over the winter. When I returned from my trip at Yule, a well-written report was awaiting me, detailing the dispositions of each elector and the likelihood that they could be turned. In some cases, he indicated the best way to do that, either through bribery, extortion, or conquest. In fact, he had identified three key barons whose allegiance would likely cement the question. I'd passed the intelligence on to a grateful Drainer. He'd been using his position as my court wizard, with my tacit permission, to prepare a plan of action against his hostile relatives for a year now. He was using his lands and estates in Morrows as staging grounds for the anticipated war he'd have to fight to conquer their domains. For the last 6 months, he'd been quietly interviewing mercenary companies and individual war magi.
He'd invested a significant amount of gold in their hire, I knew. They were quietly heading toward Moros and gathering without attracting attention. That was in addition to the knights and vassals he'd inherited with his lands. "So how are you fixed for troops?" I asked casually.
"In addition to my magical corps, I have 120 archers my cousin has trained from my domain and his, 22 knights, 61 sergeants, and 55 men-at-arms. My cousin is housing my main mercenary force, the combined companies of the Masters of Field Heavy Cavalry Unit and Bellat's Company, light infantry, 600 horsemen in all. Then I have a unit of veteran crossbowmen quartered at the Barrel and Table Inn in Imacilius, in the west. The small but venerable Sir Oak Fellows Company of Noble Cavalry in Laterstown, and two companies of Wenchari Infantry hired from my friend and former client, Baron Akuton of Skitia," he said proudly. "With the hiring of Akutuan's Avengers."
"Akutuan's Avengers?" I asked incredulously.
"A new company, but made up of veterans of the Stalwart Sons and the Everbrave," he explained. "Both well-known companies. They experienced a change in leadership recently, and their new captain has agreed to bring his 500 men with me tomorrow's. Altogether, I will have well over 3,000 fighting men, distributed about the county. When I make my challenge, I shall have the men to back up my claim already in place to strike," he declared.
"What if your brother can rally sufficient support to rebuff you?"
"He'll have to defend his county seat first,"
Drainus grinned.
"As soon as hostilities begin, I shall have half my war magi and Oakfellas company immediately attack Rubium Fola, while the rest of my troops invade Innutulius's personal lands," he said with satisfaction. "By the time he realizes what he faces, he will be unprepared and overwhelmed."
"That's a fair plan," I agreed after some thought, "as long as he doesn't suspect anything and prepare a defense."
"He does not,"
Drinus assured me. "My agents have been most thorough in spreading the rumor that I no longer desire the position, and that I am content with my arcane studies," he said, pushing the last basket of miscellaneous items into a hockster. "When my brother heard I'd accepted a post with the spellmonger, he not only relaxed his vigilance, he increased the exploitation of his office. His forces are in even worse shape than when I initially threatened to press my claim," he said, with a sense of satisfaction.
"That appears to be everything," he sighed. "It is time to take horse."
"I want to thank you for your excellent service, Drainus," I said, with a formal bow in the Ramiran style. "You have truly set the standard for what I expect in a court wizard."
"You will be well served by Master Loika,"
he assured me, returning the bow.
"I was hesitant at first, as he is a war mage."
"Probably the best one who ever lived," I reminded him.
"Just so. Yet in managing the transition, I find him to also be a capable and intelligent administrator," he added, with a note of surprise in his voice. "He was particularly interested in continuing my effort to improve the arcane library of the barony. Quite a scholar for a war mage," he reflected approvingly. "The Wenchari are known for both. Please let me know if there is anything else I can do."
"I will keep the king off your neck as long as I can," I promised, "but there are limits to my influence."
"If all goes as planned, then it should be over before the king even hears about it,"
Drainus said,
"and by then it will be too late. Farewell, Baron."
"Farewell, Mage Lord," I replied, as I saw him to the door of the little tower that had been his home for nearly 2 years. "May Ifnir and Huin favor you." He nodded one final time as he mounted the charger he'd purchased and joined a squadron of mercenary cavalry and a couple of stray war magi who'd enlisted in his expedition. The rest of his recently hired mercenaries were in an inn in Bovar village, waiting for him to depart. I watched as the Ramiran wizard rode away with his men, looking far less like the robed mage who'd come to me originally, and far more like the regal and determined mage lord, well armored and armed, in command of troops that he now was. It was an interesting example of how dramatically things had changed for my profession in just a few years. Court wizards were learning war magic and prosecuting their claims as mage lords. Spellmongers were ruling baronies. Foot wizards were dressing and acting like burghers. Where once practical adepts were seen as mere parasites on commerce, now they commanded merchant fleets and long convoys of trade wagons, and growing fortunes in gold. That was progress. Progress that would continue with or without me, now, I knew.
I had encouraged enough different wizards to establish themselves on their own, and, through the arcane orders, set up institutions to protect and defend both the mage lords and the other magi from being returned to their previous diminished state. With mage lords like Draenus, Pentandra, Astaral, Taran, and my other friends and allies having independent power bases spread throughout the kingdom, and the censorate crushed in exile, there just wasn't much chance that magic would be relegated back into the slums of society. Wizards were here to stay in the kingdom of Castelshar. They would help steer it through the coming times, no matter what other politics raged. That would persist, I reflected with satisfaction, as Draenus disappeared through the gate, no matter what happened to me when I went to Olam Seheri. Chapter 2. A Letter from His Highness. A message awaited me when I finally returned to the castle, held in the hand of an anxious page. The seal it bore explained why he was anxious. The message had arrived at Sevendor Castle by way of the mirror array in town, and delivered to my page before breakfast. Thank Brigger, the lad had the decency to wait until I'd gotten into my second cup of tea before he presented it to me. The official seal of the mirror array, and the use of the good parchment, told me it was trouble before I even opened it. To His Excellency Baron Minelin, the Spellmonger of Sevendor. His Highness, Prince Tavard, Duke, by the grace of the gods of Castol, deigns to bring his family to pilgrimage at the Holy Everfire that has manifested by Brigger's grace in his barony of Sevendor, so that they might remark on its nature and receive the benefits of its blessings at the festival of Brigger's Day. Attend to his ducal counsellor, Sir Dasuos, when he arrives in preparation for the occasion of His Highness's visit to his loyal vassal, and lend him all available consideration for accommodation of His Highness's party. S. Raymond of Lancelorn, Ducal Scribe. I get mirror messages pretty frequently, about all sorts of things, and usually they were delivered open, scrawled on regular parchment stock by the receiving mage, and delivered without seal. The only time they bother with that sort of thing is if it is labelled sensitive about the arcane orders, or someone actually paid money to send the note to me through the magical array. I suppose everyone at the high table that morning knew that I'd received word of something horrible when I set down my cup and issued a choice string of invective that blasphemed every divinity within earshot. Sire Kay looked up from his porridge. Something amiss, Excellency. Despite the spellmonger's breakfast rule of casual address during these informal meetings, Kay exempted himself from the rule he rigorously enforced on others. Castellan's prerogative. Yes, I sighed heavily. It's your lucky day, Kay. He raised his thick eyebrows. So lucky that it required you to suggest the goddess of luck perform that particular act on herself with that particular vegetable. She has it coming, I said unapologetically. You are going to get to cross off one more highly coveted item on whatever chivalric honor code you knights use. And what would that be, Excellency? He asked serenely. Hosting your liege at an important occasion, I said, tossing him the parchment. He read it carefully, and then folded it up again with reverence. When he looked up again, there was a particular look in his eyes that I've come to associate with knights. My war mage colleagues and I call it itchy spurs. That's when they are overcome with an opportunity to live up to the chivalric ideal in some obtuse, obscure, or violent manner, and gods help anything that got in their way. As knights are essentially civil as well as military officers in the feudal structure, there were all sorts of social components to their cult. I don't want to even discuss the religious elements. Doing the destroyer's chivalric clergy are legendary. I even understood it somewhat. Sparks, combat and support war magi in the various magical corps across history, have their own measures and standards of greatness, and they can be just as obtuse, obscure, and violent. Now that the war magi had become mage lords and high magi, some of those elements were becoming ingrained in the emergent culture, as Pentandra was fond of pointing out. Hells, the three biggest mage lords of the Wilderlands, Astaral, Azar, and Wenik, were all old comrades of mine
who seemed to be competing for professional bragging rights about their achievements in the craft. Currently, Azar single-handedly charging a dragon in the middle of a burning palace put him on top, but I suspected Wenik was already plotting something else as brazenly heroic to supplant him. But the opportunity to feast and host a liege lord in grand chivalric style was one thing on every worthy knight's list of professional achievements. I found the prince's arrival an annoyance and headache. Sire Kay saw it as an opportunity to compound his chivalric honour. So, my wizardly wisdom told me it was best to put him in charge, let him bask in the glory of a lavish showing, present his pretty wife and children to his highness, and show off the prosperous mage land that the chief of the knight's magi had nurtured. All I had to do was pay for it all. The expense didn't concern me that much, as I was currently pretty comfortable. In fact, even the loan guarantees I'd extended secretly to the Duke of Alshar had been unexpectedly cancelled when he was presented a fortune in back taxes by my former apprentices, so I was more than prepared to drop a purse of gold on this circus if it kept me from being bothered with the details. My problem, besides the innately annoying person of Tavard himself, was that this sort of thing was really interrupting my planning and plotting to do far more important things than flatter Tavard's vanity. So I gave it to Sire Kay, and he relished it, I could tell. He had itchy spurs.
"I'll host him in the new castle, of course," he said aloud. He meant the new gatehouse, but since my neighbours were all a bit concerned with the size of the new fortress behind my crappy old fortress, I was hesitant about bragging about the massive, brand-new fortress I was having built in the mountain behind it. So I'd quietly instructed everyone to refer to it as the new castle, not the new gatehouse, at least until we were ready to show off the real new castle. By then, Sevendor will have assured our neighbours of our peaceful intent, I hoped. Conversely, we'd really need a real new castle if we hadn't. Feudal politics, in case you haven't realised it, are complicated.
"We will, of course, have to hold a tournament of some sort, in His Highness's honour," he began reciting. "A banquet afterwards, as a manner of course, and that doesn't include the Briggers' Day festivities, which will have to be rearranged to accommodate their highnesses. Can I count on you to arrange for some arcane illuminary entertainments, Master Loico?" he asked my new court wizard politely.
"That was more Master Drainus's avocation,"
Loico Venaren, one of the greatest war magi of our age, admitted as he peeled a hard-boiled egg. My new court wizard looked uncomfortable with the request on his first full day on the job. "But I think with the number of ego wizards in Sevendor Town, we can find someone to dazzle the prince's fancies." "Why not make it a competition?" I suggested. "Brigga is the goddess of inspiration, and you can get the temple to sponsor it. Offer a fat prize. Present the winner at the banquet, where he can talk about how he did it with her combustioness's divine guidance or something. That would help further cement the good relations between the town's growing clerical community and the influx of magi that was already starting to cause some professional issues on both sides."
"An excellent idea, and demonstrative of Sevendor's unique position," Sire Kay agreed enthusiastically. "Do you think we could persuade the Alka Alon to lend us a chorus of their folk to perform for His Highness?"
"Whatever you need," I promised expansively. "See if they can spell-sing him a new personality." That sort of talk was also covered by the spellmonger breakfast rule. Anyone could bitch, either generally or about notable personalities, even me, without fear of repercussion. I needed to know what my people really thought, if I was going to trust their judgments. If I was being an asshole, they needed at least one opportunity a day to tell me that to my face, and let me reflect on it as a man, not as a lord, wizard, or any of the other things I did.
"That actually would be a good occasion to finally see the wedding of Lady Fal to Sire Rife,"
Sister Bemia pointed out.
"We've been putting that off far too long."
My castle chaplain was right, but it wasn't Sire Rife who was the one dragging his feet on the way to the temple. Lady Fallowin had pledged to marry the brave young knight when he saved her father's life at the Battle of the Red Ice. That was 2 years ago. One of the many problems with dealing with a nearly immortal species as allies is that their ideas of soon don't match up with ours.
"She was awaiting the completion of the refuge in Hosendor," Sire Kay said,
referring to the estate-turned-Alcan settlement established as part of the marriage contract. From what I understand, it stands near completed. There are hundreds of Terra Alon there already, and hundreds more expected soon, as well as an elegant manor house for the Lord and his new bride. The Terra Alon were a sect, tribe or club, I wasn't certain what their exact standing was, of Alka Alon who had pledged to change their forms and fight with their human allies, me, mostly, against the growing darkness in the West. That was an unwelcome development among many of the more conservative members of the Alka Alon, who found the taller, stronger Humani forms, a product of Alka Alon song spells using transgenic enchantment, an affront to their shorter sensibilities. Or something like that. Personally, when you live up to 3,000 years, you'd think spending a few of them taller wouldn't be a big deal, but it was. Symbolizing the alliance, the marriage of Falowen and Sire Rife was important to both races. Performing the ceremony on Brigger's Day, in front of the prince and princess, would demonstrate how important we saw it. I wasn't certain how the Alka Alon would celebrate it, but Sire Rife was growing anxious about the wedding, and I needed to push it forward. If the holiday wasn't going to be a circus before, it would be now. I sighed. I suppose it's best to do a full baronial court, too, since I skipped the Yule court. That will assure everyone I didn't just wander off. But you did just wander off, Min, Sister Bemia chided gently as she sipped her morning ale. You disappeared with Sire Kay and didn't let anyone know where or when you'd be back. Well, it was a secret mission, I pointed out. Next time, leave a bloody note, she said sharply. I knew a lot of the administrative responsibilities fell on her and her clerks when I was gone, not to mention people all over the Vales asking her where I was. Sorry, I pleaded. Secret mission. Was it successful, at least? She asked, arching an eyebrow. After a fashion, I shrugged. I escaped with my life. I count that as a success. I was being purposefully cryptic, because there was a lot about my sudden trip to the middle of nowhere I wasn't ready to share with people yet. A wrong word in the wrong ear could dash some part of the complicated plan that was forming in my mind to achieve my every wish and desire. And with Prince Tavard showing up, his entourage filled with spies, I was feeling very security-conscious all of a sudden. But I should have been more socially conscious in retrospect. Sister Bemio reminded me of that in a lecture I knew was coming. I was dreading, and I had to endure. So did your former apprentices, she continued in a low voice. Barely. Have you spoken to them yet? Not in person, I admitted guiltily. I let them know I was back. They gave me the highlights of their mission, but they are recuperating at Taragwen Keep, she pointed out, which is a day's walk or a half-day's ride over the ridge. They were worried sick about you, she accused. I know, I said defensively. I'll go see them this evening, I promise. So was Lady Estret, she said, shooting her eyes at Sire Kay, whose eyes were glazed over in some chivalric fantasy. Taking her husband away from her children on Yule, for some damn fool secret mission, and then popping back here like you were just running into town for a pint. Do you have any idea how worried she was? She asked accusingly. I had to. Yes, I know, she said flatly. You had a secret mission, one you can't tell anyone about, while your own poor children. My poor children were being feasted and feted by their adoring grandparents in the lap of luxury, and barely noticed I was gone, I informed her. That was the first place I went, once I brought Sire Kay, Joppo, and myself back to Sevendor. Almina and Minilian were still basking in the post-Yule bliss of young children who have been stuffed with cookies and treats and given the most fantastic toys that the Enchanter's Art could produce. They and their cousins had stayed at the Baker's Hall for the holiday, and my parents and sisters had spoiled them rotten. They weren't suffering, I added guiltily. As you say, the nun conceded, unconvinced. I just hope that whatever it was you were doing was important enough to cause all that worry. It was, I assured her. You should know by now I am not prone to actual foolishness, Bemia, else none of this would have come to pass, I said, gesturing toward my peaceful, prosperous great hall.
It was late winter, but the weather was pleasant, and the doors to the hall were wide open, allowing the castle folk to go about their business.
"You hire good people,"
she said, rolling her eyes. "That I do," I agreed, yourself included. "So while I cannot elaborate on the nature or outcome of my quest, I will tell you that Lady Alia is better," I said cautiously, "and there is hope that she will be better still. You'll have to take that morsel and be content with it, because that's all I can reveal right now." The nun's eyes widened, as did a few others around the cracked stone table. "That's all you get," I repeated, "and keep even that much to yourselves. I'm certain my absence was noted in certain quarters, just as I am certain that Lady Lenadara performed her duties well, as I directed her. But sometimes wizards' business requires such sacrifices. It wasn't the first time I was called away from Sevendor, and it won't be the last. But until this matter is resolved, you're all going to have to bear with me and some inconvenience, as I have to be elsewhere. Especially now that Prince Tavard is coming here."
"That complicates things," I sighed, "in ways you cannot imagine.
I will make the best of it, and who knows what could come out of such a visit. But we will host him here with all due honour and respect, or at least Sevendor will, and I'll show up and look important. Believe me, the last thing I want with Tavard right now is any sort of quarrel or conflict." Organizing a baronial court on relatively short notice wasn't as much of a problem for me as it was my noble peers. One of the advantages of being a mage lord is that you aren't reliant on the whims of weather and the lives of messengers to communicate with your vassals and allies. Nor did I have to wait days for a reply. Every one of my vassal domains now had a resident wizard installed, at my own expense, to handle arcane affairs for their territory. For those few who were high magi, possessing Irionite, it was a matter of a mental conversation. For the rest, I had the local baronial mirror array send word. By nightfall of the morning I got the message. All of my vassals and local allies had been informed of the prince's pilgrimage to Sevendor, and the special baronial court I would hold in his honour. There was a significant amount of business piling up since the last real court I held, sometime before Greenflower. Sire Kay was adept at stalling important matters, thank Lewin, but I had to give the barony some official attention. There were matters such as the continuing problems in Northwood, the wedding of Lady Fallowen and Sire Rife, a number of minor issues regarding the new barony in Sashtalia, people to honour, people to punish. Mage Lord stuff. It would take me a few days to consult with Kay and his staff about it. That would be tedious but necessary. I wish that was the extent to which I had to prepare, but the truth was, having Tavard here was inviting political disaster in any number of ways. My young liege was proud, bellicose, and not particularly bright. That is, he was about typical of his age and class, not really any better or worse than most of the nobility. But Tavard was a bully. He was used to power he hadn't earned, and as a result, he was subject to whims and reactions that an older, wiser man would be wary of. Worse, he was so heavily favoured by his mother that she'd shielded the boy from honest criticisms that might have made him stronger. There were plenty of court rumours about episodes from his youth, when his impetuous nature and viciousness, something else that Queen Grendine encouraged in her son, led to a variety of minor scandals. What's killing a few peasants or sporting with the wives of your vassals against their will, after all? While I'd been careful to distance the arcane orders from royal politics, I hadn't been entirely ignorant of what transpired in Castabriel. I'd watched the decline in importance of my own people and the increase in importance of Remeran commercial interests, and I was perfectly happy with that. Mage Lord Planus was a close friend and business partner, and he was ideally positioned to inform me of what was happening through his insidious web of commercial contacts in the court. Courts, actually, because there was a growing political split in the kingdom as King Rard was trying to establish a true government for all of his territories from his new palace at Kaunas, north of Castabriel, while his son, 20 miles down the road, seemed to be determined to contest important issues as Duke of the richest part of the realm.
It was well known that there was a lot of resentment festering under the surface after the coronation that the Castalli had all worked so hard to pull off. Rad and Grendene had to broaden the ministers of the royal court to reflect their new realm, including prominent Wenshari, Remeran, and even Alshari nobles for important political reasons. That left the remnants of the old Castalli ducal court with their best minds gone. New ministers had replaced the old, ambitious men who were quite willing to accept a powerful position at a mere ducal court rather than the royal court. And with the titular management passed over to brash young Tavard, there were already scandals and plots brewing. Chief among the plotters was the new ducal prime minister, Count Moran. The ambitious noble hadn't been invited to any official position in the royal government, so he was quick to advance himself as the replacement for the previous prime minister, the venerable Count Kindine, who got kicked upstairs. The Castalli high nobles welcomed him as a counter to the sudden importance of Remir in the royal councils, and in the last few years, Moran had slowly but surely promoted his own partisans into positions of power within the ducal administration. Now that the king had unofficially left the ducal palace in Castabriel for his grander new royal palace at Kaunas, Count Moran had crushed opposition and consolidated power in the ducal capital. That was starting to produce some friction, as the two power centres disentangled from each other. Moran was subtle, though, and would not move overtly against the royal court. He was too afraid of Grendine's army of pretty assassins, but that didn't stop him from causing trouble in other ways. Everything had come to a head, Planus informed me, when Princess Radine was captured at sea, along with some royal ministers and her entire entourage, by pirates off the coast of Faris. Instead of demanding ransom themselves, as was traditional, the pirates sold off their prize to the rebels in Anultramar, who in turn traded her to Corbal the Necromancer. That raised a permanent split in the courts. The royal court was, officially, furious at the kidnapping and was, officially, pursuing all means to secure Radine's release. But Tavard's ducal court, under Moran's guidance, was dead set against that course of action. Instead, it had agitated for an all-out assault on Anultramar to punish the rebels for their role in the crime. And, along the way, conquer the richest part of Alshar for Tavard's own. None of which did a damn thing to rescue Radine from Corbal. But it gave Tavard every excuse to try to raise a fleet to assail the most heavily guarded maritime power in the five duchies. Meanwhile, Tavard and Moran were taking every possible opportunity to snipe at his poor cousin Duke Anguin, whose attempt at re-establishing his rule at Verone, the summer capital of Alshar, was interrupted by a dragon destroying his palace. That had provided His Highness and his gentlemen at court a great deal of amusement. There were even satirical songs being sung about the hapless orphan duke who couldn't seem to do anything right. That was fine by me. I wanted him to underestimate his cousin. What Tavard and his court didn't know, but were probably beginning to expect, was that until recently I was propping up the nascent Alshari government through loan guarantees, through the Arcane Orders and the Temple of Ifnia. I'd helped recruit the core of his ducal court, loaned him my very best administrative mage as his court wizard, found him an ideal soldier as his minister of war, and an underappreciated court noble as a prime minister. Thankfully, all had survived the destruction of the palace. And while the government was now being run from the various picturesque estates around Verone, and not from the palace, it was still functioning. Indeed, it was arguably functioning better. With Mage Lord support, Anguin was beginning to construct a new, more secure palace at Verone. And with the help of my two sneaky former apprentices and a family of truly gifted magical thieves, the orphan duke now had a bulging treasury with which to pay for it. None of that was known at the Castalli ducal court. They saw Anguin as a young, backwards buffoon, weak, poor, stupid and pretentious, barely scraping by in the rustic wilderlands. And they saw the remainder of his rebellious realm as ripe for conquest. In the middle of all this was Queen Grendene, herself raised in Anultramar in the Alshari ducal house before she was married off to Rad. Her ambitions to own Anultramar were legendary. So she technically favoured Tavard's desire to conquer it. But growing up in Alshar also gave her a far more realistic idea of what it would take to assault Anultramar and the southern Alshari vales. Tavard's bold idea for conquest was doomed, and she knew it. Worse,
The old bitch seemed quite willing to abandon the daughter she'd raised as the heir to her secret intelligence service in favor of her securing her son's eventual rise to the throne. Losing a daughter, who was seemingly impossible to marry off, was a small price to pay for ensuring Tavard took the crown one day. I was no admirer of Radin, who'd tried to kill me once, but I was sympathetic to her plight. That's why her rescue made such a good distraction, in more ways than one, and why Tavard's unexpected pilgrimage to Sevendor was so problematic. If he caught wind that I was behind even attempting such madness, it undermined his reasons for assailing an Ultramar. More, if His Highness discovered just how much power and wealth I'd amassed in Sevendor, he would try to find some way to steal it. That's just how nobles think. So the first thing I had to do in preparation was hide the big stuff. Thankfully, I had a partially hollowed-out mountain that, at this point, still looked like a mountain. The construction around the three entrances into the diggings looked more like a staging ground for building the beautiful new gatehouse, the Muse Tower that was nearing completion, and the new fortifications on my borders than it did anything else. Covering and obscuring the main tunnels into the growing complex was easy. Master Guri and his folk had already built a temporary vault down near the Snowflake Chamber for much of my secure work on enchantment. Another held the bulk of my fortune in gold and silver, and that didn't even count the special third vault in the Westwood that only a few knew about. But I had my men move as much of my other wealth, magical and mundane, into the vaults anyway, just to be safe. I'd been robbed recently, and taxed regularly. No need to take chances with either. I didn't even know all the wonders I owned, and the chaos of Brigger's Day would be a perfect time for an enterprising housebreaker to raid me. I'm not paranoid. Lots of people don't like me. I try not to take it personally. If I was afraid of theft, I was even more afraid of threats against my family, and Sevendor, and, I regretted to say, Prince Tavard and the royal family. As much as I didn't like the asshole, having him harmed in Sevendor would not be in my interest. To that end, I hired additional security. Not only did I send a summons to most of my vassals for sergeants to help keep the expected crowds in line, I sent Gareth down to the Staff and Sword to hire some extra war magi. There are always a handful of professional war magi hanging around the tavern when they're in Sevendor. Not that there's a lot of business for them here, usually, though Draenor's had been steadily interviewing them and hiring the ones he liked. But there was a lot of gossip and professional advantages to wintering in town before the season began. Picking up a couple of extra stags and becoming known to the spellmonger for doing what they were essentially doing anyway was simple. Gareth found 6 decent fellows willing to take my coin and my orders and put them on the payroll immediately. He deputized them as spell wardens, and I directed them to start paying attention to any newcomers who arrived ahead of the festivities, as well as general security during the festival. It was a lot of effort. By dinner time, the entire vale was bustling with activity as the news spread and the orders began to pour out. Sire Kay was still commanding the effort from the high table in the castle when I had my horse saddled for the trip to Tarragwen, through the back way we'd cut through the Westwood. He was in his element, as he made lists and scribbled orders, sending messengers all over the barony. He was hosting the prince, himself, on behalf of his liege. I felt the most sorry for Lady Estret, who just got her husband back from errantry, only to lose him again to the demands of chivalry. Spur, fever. Don't let it happen to you. Chapter 3. Consultations. It annoyed me that Tavard was forcing me to divert my attention from what was most important right now, I reflected as I rode my new rouncy through the secret shortcut to Castle Tarragwen, but I had little choice in the matter. Despite my intentions to pursue a raid against Ulam Saheri with all speed, now I had to drop everything and cater to the details of a sudden state visit. As I rode along the darkened path on my strong new horse, who I'd yet to name, I decided to do a little bitching about my situation. Mage Lord's prerogative. It was dark, and I was reasonably certain Pentandra would be done with dinner, even though it was a few hours earlier over in Verone. I summoned the sigil that connected the temporary witch stone around my neck to contact her mind to mind. "So, you've finally returned to Sevendor,"
she said, an observation, not an accusation. "Did you find what you were seeking when you so rudely disappeared?"
"I did," I replied, pleased, "and I think I have a plan to restore Alia. I met a powerful new ally. I made the acquaintance of an ancient Alka-Alon sorceress, who also happens to have been present during the colonization of Perwin," I bragged. "It seems she knows something which might possibly be used to stitch Alia's consciousness back together in a reasonable fashion."
"How is she, Min?"
Penny asked, genuinely concerned. "She's a little better," I conceded reluctantly. I had to be honest with Penny.
"Lelastian, the sorceress of Sartha Wood. She's not a myth?"
Pentandra asked, surprised.
"I always thought she was some wild witch who'd escaped the censors."
"She's no witch. She's a, well, a doctor, among other things. A human doctor. But she's also Ithalia's grandmother, a specialist on human anatomy and culture, and she's been imprisoned in her home by the Council for the last 400 years. I convinced the Council to grant her a temporary parole to help with the war effort. 10 years.
"We get a powerful spell singer for 10 years. How in 5 hells did you negotiate that? Without me?"
she asked, sounding hurt. "I got lucky," I demurred. "In any case, she's identified something which might help put Alia's mind aright, or at least more right than it is. As it was, she was able to coax a little more awareness and responsiveness out of her."
"Well, that's encouraging.
So where is this spell?" "That's the bad news. It's in the basement of Olam Saheri, guarded by Korbal's minions. It's the enneagram of a subsidiary creature of the Celestial Mothers, one she called the Handmaiden. If we can successfully sneak in there and access the ghost rock beneath Olam Saheri, we can copy the enneagram and use it. It's supposed to support and regulate enneagrams," I explained.
"And we have to reanimate it?"
Pentandra asked, skeptically.
"Min, that sounds an awful lot like necromancy."
"Only because it is exactly like necromancy," I pointed out. "We'd be using the shade of a long-dead creature, energizing it and essentially bringing it into a limited kind of unlife. That's pretty much the definition of necromancy."
"You can do that?"
"We're going to find out," I promised. "I've been meeting with my on-staff specialist about it to learn the basics, and I've been doing my own investigations. If we can figure out a few technical details, it might work. Removing the center point from the snowflake is the hard part. That's the first step. I've got my private bulleterion working on it. Once that's done, we can proceed to the really dangerous part.
The raid on Olam Saheri.
The fortress of Korbal the Necromancer," she replied with dread. "Yeah, that. That's going to be the other hard part. Especially the getting back out alive part. But I have the bare bones of a plan," I said, hopefully.
"No doubt," she said unenthusiastically. "You do realize that the fortress is incredibly isolated, beyond the worst terrain of the Land of Scars, infested with goblins and trolls, filled with wretched human slaves and evil undead, and guarded by dragons?"
"I've been there before, remember?"
"I do. You almost died, as did my husband. And now you want to go back.
Only now the place is a fetid lake, and the city is a real fortress, not an Alka-Alon fancy. And it's garrisoned by soldiers who have toiled to make it impregnable. It's also filled with wyverns," I added helpfully. "When the lads returned from their excursion, they reported that the island is now home to hundreds of scaly, flying predators about the size of a cat."
"Wyverns? I've heard of them. Like a snake with claws and wings?"
"Korbal probably cultivated them to keep the hawks at bay," Pentandra reasoned. "Dragons are too big to screen for them. That many ferocious flyers will make scouting by air problematic."
"I hadn't thought of that," I admitted.
"Damn, this is going to be tougher than I thought."
"It's always tougher than you think," she chided.
"We have some advantages," I pointed out. "For one thing, Tyndall and Rondell and their friends not only gathered some good intelligence, they apparently sighted the princess. Radin is languishing in a cell in Olam Saheri. I'm on my way to their clubhouse to hear the entire story."
"So Radin is in enemy hands. I had so hoped that was mere rumor.
That gives Corbal all the leverage he needs to keep Rad from being too aggressive.
You would think, I sighed. From what I understand, there is little interest in the royal court to mount any kind of rescue mission. Oh, they've offered a rich reward to the hero who can rescue her, blah, 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 and they've made threats. Only against the rebel counts of an Ultramar, who don't have her.
What in six hells? Pentandra swore. Are they mad? She knows more about the security of the kingdom than the sodding prince. A detail that, thankfully, Corbal does not suspect, or does not care about, yet. But it's almost inevitable that he discovers it, should he bring himself to question her. No killer tarts to protect her in a prison cell, so we have a very limited amount of time in which to act.
You want to rescue Radin?
It's not my first choice, I admitted, but as we're going to be raiding the fortress of an evil necromancer anyway, we might as well pick up some souvenirs.
Min, that's mad.
I know, I sighed, but it's my only choice. If I want to restore Alia, and even that is only a possibility. Oh, but it gets better, I added, remembering something she needed to know. You remember that imprisoned Alcan sorceress I mentioned? Turns out she's more familiar with humanity's situation on Kalador than we are. The Seafolk are actually in charge, and the rest of us are their guests. They pretty much leave us alone, as long as we don't disturb their fishy realm. But the Alka Alon, who are also tenants here, have already screwed up enough to be put on probation. One more incident, and they will be evicted.
Evicted? How?
I suppose they'll call the Reeve or something. I don't know, but it's dire. The Seafolk are already wary after what we did to Perwin. Apparently they gave us a perfectly good island, and we sunk it.
Hey, that was over 700 years ago.
If the Alka Alon have long memories, the Sea Folks are much longer. Lilastian was terrified of the possibility of Corbal or Sherul doing something to disturb the peace enough for the Vandal to intervene.
So going to spit in Corbal's eye is going to keep him from pissing in the shallow sea?
She asked, confused. Corbal and his brood are determined to overthrow the Council and rule this realm, I pointed out. Not attacking them isn't going to keep that from happening. No. After speaking with the Lastian, I'm convinced that ending the threat from the enemy quickly is our best course of action. That means more direct engagement.
Triggs, Womb-Min, you are trying to get yourself killed, she accused.
Not at all. We're far better prepared than we were 5 years ago. We have scores of trained war magi, far more powerful weapons, some potent high magi, and the advantages that Snowstone and the Snowflake give us, I pointed out. Our waystones give us a means of secret travel, our pocket stones lighten our loads, and we have powerful new allies.
The Terra Alon,
she supplied. Yes, the Terra Alon. Whatever it is that motivates a 3-foot Alka Alon to transform into a 6-foot, perfect physical specimen of near humanity, find out a way to get us more. Reports say that hundreds, perhaps thousands of Alka Alon have followed Lord Eratas and the emissaries in taking humanish forms. The way the movement is spreading among the Alkan refugees is almost cultish, from what Unranyan tells me.
Arborn has met with several bands who wish to get the enchantment, Pentandra confirmed. They are enthusiastic, she agreed, but Arborn mistrusts their motivations and their expectations of what Humani-style war will be like.
Of course, the Terra Alon will have to learn how to fight all over again, with human-style weapons. But with some advice and good armament, they will be a formidable force, and one intimately familiar with what has become of Fair and Thaddeel.
So, zealots to match the Enshadowed's fanatics,
she snorted mentally. Oh, the Enshadowed have adopted larger forms with which to fight, too, I informed her. Transgenics left over from their warring states, period. A group of them tried to overcome Lelastian's defences, once the Council opened her cell at Yule. They're human-sized, but they're different than the transgenically enchanted bodies our friends use. They're sharper, slenderer, more angular, with longer arms and legs. Their eyes are more widely spaced on their faces, and their hair is uniformly black. Their skin is more mottled, too, I recalled. And their voices are less bell-like and more hoarse, darker.
They sound pleasant,
she said distastefully.
Where did they come up with such...
The old Alca-Alon Wars, I answered. Nelastian told me about it. Those were warrior forms, designed for combat. It's one of the reasons that the Alca-Alon are so prejudiced against transgenic enchantments in the first place. Various houses and sects had their own versions, but at the height of the hostilities, most battles were fought with those kinds of forms, or some even worse. When the war started, our war, the Enshadowed must have dusted them off. Not that it did them much good.
They'll get better,
Pentandra promised. So will our friends, I countered. Once Aratas settles into his new encampment near Sevendor, we can start outfitting his people properly and teach them how to be deadlier in battle.
You do realize you're talking about a civilization that was ancient before it arrived here, 10,000 years ago,
she pointed out.
They understand war.
Sure they do, I soothed. Pentandra had been getting more and more testy during her pregnancy, which was totally understandable. She was having triplets. But they haven't had to practice the art in generations. Not really. The Avalanti are nearly pacifists, unless threatened. The Versarotti are militant by tradition, not necessity. This is the first time they've been seriously threatened in millennia. From what Varan tells me, most of her kin don't even consider the Gavani worthy of fighting. But this crisis is going to call for both kindreds to reassess their cultural priorities. The Terra Alon are the best step in that direction.
We've started seeing them more in the Wilderlands, Pentandra agreed. They're working with the Kasari to patrol the Penumbra. We're talking about building a camp for them up in the northeast, near the Anvil. Since we already have a pretty extensive quarry camp up there, that shouldn't be too difficult to establish.
How is Varone surviving without the palace?
Well enough, she conceded. The major ministries have relocated to the surrounding estates when they can. Believe it or not, without all the regular meetings, I'm actually getting a lot more done. We've cut it down to one day a week, usually in one of the finer townhomes in Varone, sometimes a temple. But Varone is making up for the lack of the ministries with a boom in construction. Carmella has been working all winter long to clear the ruins of the old palace and lay the foundations of the new castle. With magic and lavish budget for labour. She laid the cornerstone at Yule and says the first walls will be completed by Ishi's Day.
That's impressive, I remarked. Usually it took an engineer a couple of years to get that far. But then Carmella had an open-ended budget, complete freedom to build, and magical construction techniques that allowed her to move much more quickly than a traditional engineer. She was also getting assistance from a few petty dwarves, the rustic Karshak clans traditionally in charge of the low-status production of wood. How is Anguin doing? I asked, almost afraid to hear the answer.
Much better than I would have thought, for a boy whose only home was destroyed by a dragon, she conceded. He only brooded for about a week after you left. Then he got to work. Since then he's been a model duke, burying himself in the details of his court. Everyone is getting paid on time. The local estates are set to plant this spring, and he's got the